Well, this is me, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and this is me on the screen here, riding towards the camera.
And I'm Paul Verhoeven, I'm the director. The movie was originally was produced by the company that you see, whose name you see arriving here on the screen, which is Carolco, by Andy Vanya and Mario Casar. And I myself did a couple of movies there, this one, and later Basic Instinct, and to a certain degree Showgirls.
I did a film, of course, which was called Red Heat, and after that great experience that I had with Carolco, with Mario Casar and Andy Vanya, I definitely wanted to do another movie there, so this was the perfect movie. A big budget, big movie, Total Recall.
And then later you did Terminator 2 there.
I did Terminator 2, that's right, and of course we will be doing many more projects together, hopefully.
There were about 30 versions of the script before we got it. And they were all done by Dan O'Bannon and Ron Suchet. Then the version that we are seeing here, that was an additional writer I asked to come in, which was Gary Goldman. And that most of the work that was done on the script was in the third act. Two writers were with us on the set all the time, Ron Suchet and Gary Goldman. I think we were a very writer-friendly group, because they were part of everything and they could see as much of the dailies and have as much input as they wanted.
I remember that exactly, how long the script was around, because I followed it. And I remember when Dina De Laurentiis was in pre-production for this movie over in Australia, and he then finally got into financial trouble. And I called him and I asked him if he would sell the movie, and he said yes. And then I immediately called Carolco and said to Andy Vanya and Mario Casar, call Dina De Laurentiis right now and buy this movie. And bang, within a few hours, they owned the movie, and that's when I got in touch with you then. And recall, remember when I
that
said
you asked
you,
me to do the movie?
Well, I said, remember our conversation we had at the restaurant?
Right, right.
Because right after RoboCop came out, I went to you in a restaurant and butted in right there during the conversation you had with someone else. And I said, Paul, you're the greatest. They're so RoboCop. You're fantastic. We have to work together and all that stuff. And then, you know, that was the movie we worked on together.
This is all special effects, what you see here. Only the people that are discovered later on there in the background, you see two people walking. The people, of course, are real. Everything else is blue screen.
Now, all this was shot, of course, in the studios in Churubusco, in Mexico.
And a very small studio this part was, because there was no money at all anymore for these scenes, remember?
Yeah,
so
exactly.
We had to shoot it on a stage that was not much bigger than a basketball field at the maximum, isn't it? On the credit list that just passed by, you saw a lot of people that worked with me on other movies, notably on RoboCop and Hollow Man and Starship Troopers, Jos Vacano for the photography, Frank Urosti for the editing, Bill Sandel, who did RoboCop, Erika Phillips for costume, did also RoboCop, and this movie. And this is a Robotine effect. It's Arnold as a puppet. It's not a digital effect, it didn't exist at that time. You would now do it digitally, I suppose, but at that time it was just something, a puppet where the eyes were blown out, kind of.
This was one of my favorite scenes, obviously, because how many times do people get a chance to wake up with Sharon Stone? Remember how we rehearsed this scene?
We rehearsed it in the Bellagio Hotel.
In the Bellagio Hotel, exactly. We went up there. They must have thought that we had some strange Hollywood characters checking in, like, you know, two guys with one woman in this bedroom. And we were rehearsing exactly this scene here, the fight scene and playing around in the bed and all those kind of things. But it was really good, because it was several months before and we were very well prepared. So when we did actually the scene there, we knew exactly what we were doing.
Realize here also that she could be, of course, she could be really a nice woman who is really worried about his nightmares about Mars, isn't it? I mean, there are two realities to the movie all over the place, and I'll emphasize that throughout. But it's not necessarily so at this point that Sharon Stone is already the Cohagen agent that she might turn out to be later. So she can just be somebody that is pissed off because he seems to be dreaming always about the brunette, while she hopes that she's dreaming about that she's that he's dreaming about her.
Exactly.
You know I do.
At this point, I think we asked Sharon Stone basically to take part of her clothes off, but she was very timid here. Remember?
She makes
a little thing there. I think I took revenge in Basic Instinct, you know.
No, I think that the whole thing worked really well.
No, it's very nice. For this kind of movie, you don't want to go further, clearly. Saying that space-based weapons are our only effective defense against the Southern Bloc's nuclear... Now there is a political agenda is introduced here, isn't it? Where we find out that there are problems on the colony Mars that is under the supervision of Governor Cohagen. Clearly, it is of course A, referring to, let's say, colonial situations of England or Spain or Holland, but it could also be a metaphor for any kind of imperialism.
You know, what's so interesting is looking at it now, is how futuristic in those days it was to have a big screen, and now we are in the future.
Right.
You know, now everyone
kind of
has
normal,
a big screen.
Yes.
Exactly, a flat screen on the wall.
Well, even this thing that we did here, I mean, she puts it out and we get suddenly to this landscape that was done by a trick where before this happens, in the same shot, the walls are already fake. The two side walls are blue screen. So when we get the whole landscape, of course, the landscape is printed in over these three areas.
Right.
But the side areas next to the television in the beginning are fake walls.
It's dry, it's ugly, it's boring. I mean, really, revolution could break out there.
In fact, of course, this was shot with blue screen, but I think that is kind of a reality. All these things are preparing us for double realities, isn't it?
Exactly.
But one thing, it seems to be one thing, it turns out to be another thing. Back now, the walls there are also fake. These are basically printed in walls.
Right.
And then later, when we cut to the shots, to the next shots, when you would see the backgrounds, then it are the walls that we constructed. But for these two shots where the transition takes place, the two side walls next to the screen are always fake. Here, it's real.
It was a great scene because she's trying so hard for me not to see the news. Not to see what's going on Mars. And she realizes that I'm fascinated by this. You can see here with the eye, you know, no matter what I do, the kissing, the hugging with her, I'm more interested in what's going on Mars. So there's a part of me that knows about the subject.
Which could be because he starts vaguely to remember things that he should not remember.
That's right.
Or it's just an obsession, if the rest is all dreamlike, then it would just be a general obsession with Mars.
Right.
And again, she tries to influence him in a way to say, no, don't worry about that, that's not true, there is nothing about Mars, it's all an invention of you, and which could be her part as a loving wife that tries to protect her husband,
right.
Or she is already basically here trying to prevent his memory to break through.
Right, exactly.
And so she's a Cohagen agent then. I mean, here, when we hold on her face, of course, we pretend a little bit that there is something else going on.
Exactly. And, you know, it was very important for us to show that my mind is set on something totally different, that I'm not really living in the moment, that I'm thinking of something else.
This is all what you just saw is the military academy in Mexico City. Here is one of the first digital effects ever done. That we tried to do with capture motion, but failed completely. But fortunately, Eric Brevik had also put a camera on the other side of the screen, so we had Arnold's movements also in a natural way, and they copied that. Now, of course, here the team basically that will influence the whole movie is introduced, isn't it? The implant of dreams.
Always wanted to climb the mountains of Mars. But now
There you see the guy, watch him, that will pop up at halfway the movie. His name is Dr. Edgemar. Cheaper, safer, and better than the real thing. So don't let life... Of course, the memory implants that I sold, but that ultimately could be make you completely schizophrenic, I sold in the same nice way as the tobacco industry sells the cigarettes in it.
Exactly. Here, this is my job. I'm a construction worker.
In the original screenplay, you were an accountant.
That's right.
And we felt that it didn't fit your persona in any way.
Well, that was because of Jeff Bridges was supposed to actually play
right.
the character when
right.
Dina De Laurentiis was
yeah,
doing
and,
it.
Yeah, and Richard Dreyfuss before that.
Exactly, and then many other actors before that.
Again, here's Pell here. Could Orr be just a nice guy that tries to warn him not to go to these idiotic memory implants because they could basically make you schizophrenic? Or he is already a Cohagen agent that has to make sure that his memory doesn't pop up.
Well, that's the great thing about the movie, that from the beginning on, it always works on two levels. And the audience always has to guess, you know, what it is. What is reality and what is not.
And the music here is this kind of theme that Jerry Goldsmith introduces here, which is the kind of unclarity of if it's real or not.
Right.
Again, this trick is done reversed, isn't it? The red was already there from the beginning, but we painted it blue, basically, in the computer, kind of. And then when the red appears, it looks like we're doing there the trick, but the trick is already before. So your attempt, that's why it looks so convincing in the second part when you start to realize that there is a trick, because it is no trick. The trick was before, but you didn't pay attention. It's like a magician trick, isn't it? You always look at the wrong thing.
Thank you.
All this is all built in the studio, it's all Cherubusco, isn't it? And we use this kind of strange style, that you use this kind of concrete walls, because a lot of the buildings that we found in Mexico City were done in a style they call New Brutalism, which is all big concrete, like the underground, which you saw on the scene before, which was building of the military academy outside Mexico City. But we try to copy that style that we found there, by coincidence, and have all these, always these wall like bunker like nearly, isn't it?
Everybody raves about them. Well, the architecture was ideal in Mexico City because of the daring architecture and the colors and the shapes of the buildings and all that. We really could use that very well in a lot of the scenes. Now here, this is one of my favorite scenes, Paul, because this is really what the movie is about, when he's now selling to me the idea of recall.
Right.
To implant something.
What's in the 2-week package?
Yeah, he's trying to. He's like a car salesman, isn't it? He tries to talk you into taking whatever is close to your heart.
And no matter what question I have, he has the perfect answer.
Right, right.
And he knows already all
the
questions.
Like a car salesman.
Exactly, that's right. It's absolutely perfect. And the great line is when he says, you know, what is always the same when you travel around, no matter where you go?
Right.
And I say, I don't know what. And he says, you.
Yes.
And he's always you there.
He always says, thinks now, with you.
Exactly, we can solve that now here.
Yeah. I remember when I talked to the casting director, Mike Fenton, I said to him, you know, for this actor, Ray Baker, I said, I just find me somebody that could be very well working in a car sales company.
A real holiday is a pain in the butt. You got lost luggage, lousy...
The interesting thing is, of course, is here, that the memory implant or the dream trip that he wants... And that he basically ultimately is going to choose, isn't it, by being a secret agent and all that stuff. If you look at the movie, at the end of this scene, McLean tells him everything what's going to happen in the movie.
Right.
It's counter to every normal narrative, isn't it? You would not reveal. You would not tell the people where it's going. Here, you get to completely, the whole story is formulated for you in the end of the scene. That's what you were talking here.
Exactly,
about.
Yeah.
You are. It's always the same old you. Let me suggest that you take a vacation from yourself. I know, it sounds wild.
See, right now he knows that he has gotten to me, that I'm now interested in that. And now he's going to go all out with his selling.
Yeah, and then he basically he finds exactly what you're, somehow your unconsciousness, if you are a different person than you think you are, pushes you to take the secret agent thing, isn't it?
Let me tantalize you. You are a top.
Now he tells the story.
Exactly.
Your most important mission. People are trying to kill you left.
That's going to happen in the next 5 minutes.
Exactly.
Go on. I don't want to spoil it for you.
Now the rest of the story?
But you rest assured, by the time the trip is over, you get the girl, kill the bad guys, and save the entire
planet, which is at the end what he does.
That's right.
So this is the story, and you think this is just a salesman's job.
Well, that's why it works, because we don't pay much attention to it yet, because we know it's just a salesman's
job. But it's so fun that the whole movie is this way.
Yeah.
And here is also an interesting thing. Here are given several clues, are given inside the scene, of course, for the rest of the movie. In fact, the woman that he wants to be implanted in his dream, because he can make a choice, and she proposed him several possibilities. And so he can choose a woman that would be part of his dream. Of course, the woman that he describes is the woman he might remember. So he gets her, really. Or you could say he has a kind of a fantasy image that he dreams about, which is this girl, Melina, and he describes it as good as possible, and he gets it. Even all the images of the tubes that he just saw are, of course, the tubes that you see at the end of the movie when the nuclear reactor starts.
Right.
Hanky-panky.
But really, I was always
all
fascinated.
All systems go.
Then we're set. Ready for Dreamland?
Oh. I'll be asking you some questions, Doug, so we can fine-tune the ego program. You answer honestly, you'll enjoy yourself a whole lot more. Your sexual orientation.
Hetero.
Yeah.
I love that.
So here, this is basically where he makes his choice. And of course, if you look very in the last, when he gets more and more precise with the choice, when he defines her breast and the rest of her body, then he goes to her basically what kind of type of woman he wants. And ultimately, we end up, of course, with somebody that for a moment, just before he falls asleep, for a moment, seems to be Rachel Ticotin.
Right.
And also be aware that if everything that happens in the movie from now on is going to be a dream, if there is no reality to anything, there's Rachel. Blue Sky and Mars, another clue, isn't it, for later. Realize that the dream really starts at the moment that he falls asleep. So the next scene, which seems to be a fuck-up of the machine, is part of the dream.
Right.
So this is the last moment of his reality. Goes into the unconsciousness, and basically from now on, boom, the dream starts.
What do you say?
This is part of the dream. The elements, basically, that are shown to him are, again, McLean, because he just saw him, so his dream... So the people that made the dream built this all in to make it look for Quake as if it's completely true. The schizoid embolism is part of the dream. It's to seduce him to think that the reality has never stopped. That's the trick of the company, that they make a dream that's so convincing that it seamlessly goes from the first reality into the second one.
It's one of my favorite scenes, because it really starts the movie out the right way.
Yeah, because you think this is real.
Exactly, absolutely.
You think that basically he's upset and he wants to break out. And especially because he says this thing about Hauser, and I'm not Quaid, I'm Hauser or whatever.
Exactly, and he almost looks like he has changed his mind at the last second, or something went wrong with the implant.
Yes. And from let's say, the normal narrative, you would say, okay, the old persona that was suppressed basically is coming through for a moment.
Right.
Hauser is popping up, kind of. But basically, they suppress him. But it's not what some people have thought, that the real dream starts here. No, the dream. This is part of the dream. If you want to see the movie as a dream.
Exactly.
I mean, a normal audience would take this more like a reality, of course.
Well, that's what actually makes it work, makes it so interesting, because in the end, you ask yourself, was this all a dream or was it the reality?
Right.
So you walk away with a really interesting question.
And I think we, as much as possible, we kept these two realities always alive, isn't it? Because of Arnold, you being a superhero, of course, people would always hope and think that it's real, isn't it?
Right.
Excuse me. Someone...
But there are strong doubts about that, of course, if you look at the movie for the second time.
Okay. All right, look, here's what we're going to do. Renata, cover up any memory that he's got of us or recall.
I'll do what I can. It's pretty messy in there.
Ernie, dump him in a cab around the corner. Tiffany, you help him. I'm going to destroy his file and refund his money. And if anybody comes asking, we never even heard of Douglas Quaid.
What a great...
Yeah, it's a great setup, isn't it? So these cars were designed by Ron Kopp, and the robot here was done by Robotine. It's a very well-known element of Philip Dick stories that he uses taxis that have no real persons aboard that do the driving. He always, in a lot of his stories, he has a robotic drivers. And this one, we try to make this one a bit funny, because perhaps giving you a clue that it is still a dream. This whole building, again, is the military academy in Mexico City, so that is not nothing, all this is all real. There's no studios here, then basically the signs that we put on the walls and all that stuff. And now the story, of course, goes in overdrive, isn't it? That's basically where McLean predicted, people are going to kill you left and right. He walks into his old pal, and the old pal is saying, I'm going to kill you.
Come on, I'll buy you a drink. Listen, I'm already late. Thank you very much. But hey,
come on, move it. Let's go get that drink.
What the hell is going on? What the fuck did I do wrong? Tell me.
You blamed Quaid. You blamed about Mars.
Are you crazy? I don't even know anything about Mars.
You should have listened to me, Quaid. I was there to keep you out of trouble.
There's a great fight scene coming up now, which is...
Where he suddenly he realizes himself, to his amazement, how good he is with his body,
yeah.
Isn't it? Because he can do whatever he wants. He hits them, and he kicks them, and kills them all, one after the other.
Remember how long we rehearsed this fight scene, huh?
Yes.
For hours we were working on that thing.
He suddenly also knows how to handle a gun
in
the perfect way.
And I'm totally amazed.
And he's looking at himself.
I'm looking at the gun.
Yeah, so this is really this.
How did I do that?
Right. He got these four guys in 20 seconds and killed them all, didn't
he? Yeah.
So there's some reason for him to be disoriented about himself here.
Well, because he realizes finally maybe there is something else in me.
Here, one of the first, let's say, film holograms, I would say.
Yeah.
Again, it's still trying to give you the work with the idea what's reality and what not, isn't it?
Right.
Hi, honey. What are you doing?
Some men just tried to kill me.
Muggers? Are you all right?
No, there were spies or something. And Harry from work, he was to get down. Harry from work, he was the boss.
So she, again, is trying to tell him there's nothing happening and that you have basically something went wrong, isn't it? He said, because he tells her that he went through this recall operation, and now she realizes that he fucked up his brain. At least that's what she pretends. And of course, what she's really doing is trying to talk him out of the Mars memories.
Absolutely, and she's doing such a wonderful job in pretending that she's very concerned about me. And there's just something going on in my head right now, and I should just relax and leave it up to her.
Listen to me, sweetheart. Those assholes at Recall have fucked up your mind. You're having paranoid delusions.
You call this a delusion?
Now she realizes, in the reality of the story, one of the realities of the story, that there is a problem with Mr. Quaid. Huh?
Right.
Don't call anybody.
So she's going to call her agent boss, isn't it?
Mikey Ironside, he played that character really well.
And he tells her, of course, hey, We tried to kill him already. We didn't succeed, but now you have to do it. He is still thinking that Lori is also a victim.
Yeah.
Lori and him destroyed, and it's like a symbol of basically the relationship that doesn't exist. Isn't it? So we find out.
Here's the great fight scene with Sharon and me.
So it turns out to be that his wife is now against him too. She's suddenly in the story. She's a secret agent, isn't it?
Ow, that hurt. She was an unbelievable fighting machine, remember?
She was great, yeah.
I mean, and I think she really enjoyed it, trying to kick me and hit me and stab me and going after me. Because every time she kicked me, she said, can I do this again?
Yes.
Yeah. I didn't do it right.
She's also great with the way she throws the knife in one hand and then in the other hand and all that stuff.
Talk. I said talk.
I'm not your wife.
The hell you're not.
I swear to God, I never saw you before 6 weeks ago. Our marriage is just a memory implant.
You think I'm stupid? Remember our wedding?
It was implanted by the agency.
Falling in love?
Implanted.
Our friends, my job, 8 years together. Suppose all of this was implanted too?
The job's real. The agency set it up.
Bullshit.
They erased your identity and implanted a new one. I was written in as your wife so that I could watch you and make sure the erasure took. Sorry, Quaid. Your whole life is just a dream.
Okay, then. If I'm not me, who the hell am I?
Because it was very well organized, the whole fight, isn't it? By Vic Armstrong, mostly. Was a great second unit director and stunt coordinator, so there was no danger at all. Doug. So now finally she puts the things I put on the table, isn't it? He is not the person he thinks he is, or he was, and his whole life is a fabrication, and there is really no way. He doesn't know what he is, in fact, anymore, isn't it? I think Philip Dick is trying to tell you the situation of life, that you don't know. That's the question of all human beings, isn't it? Where do I come from? Where am I going?
Yes.
And he is here thrown in a situation where everything that was before is fake, and he just have no idea who he is, and he doesn't know, has no clue where to go. So he's the total adventurer thrown in a new world that he doesn't know, kind of.
There is knowing you.
Yeah, wherever he turns, basically from now on, he gets betrayed by people, by his closest friend, by his wife, by everyone.
Yeah, his whole life is apparently a construction, isn't it?
He cannot trust now anyone anymore. He's on his own.
It's like going aboard from leaving a ship on a new continent where you don't know anything, isn't it?
Right.
Like going to an alien planet and you have no idea what it is about. But in fact, here is worse because he has no idea about himself anymore either, isn't it?
Here, Michael Ironside shows that side of him, that he actually is in with her, and this is maybe his sweetheart.
Yeah,
this is, anyone that touches her, exactly. Anyone that touches her, he kicks aside. He played that character really tough, didn't he?
Yeah, yeah.
He's unbelievable.
He's a great guy, you know. Because I used him again in Starship Troopers.
Right.
I nearly had used him in Robocop, but then we disagreed so much about the script that we didn't do it. But he was the first choice for Robocop, before Peter Weller.
Uh-huh.
But then I thought basically that I should bring him in this one again, and then we tried, and it worked very well. Look, they're lovers, of course, you know.
Yeah.
Of course, this could be all part of his dream. Still, don't forget that, isn't it?
It's also
you
part of his...
You might still be happily married.
It's part of your sickness, too.
I think I added that.
I'm absolutely convinced. It was not in the script.
Just a European touch, you know, or perhaps a Dutch touch. This is again, you know, we used that location all the time because there was basically, it had so many angles. We go back to the military academy, to the same scene, then another of these digital effects. I
that
like that basically, to
scene,
play
yeah.
a whole scene basically, in a, like I did in Hollow Man, is to play a whole scene in a different, let's say, medium nearly, isn't it?
Right. It was very well set up early on when we saw the skeleton, kind of the X-ray
right,
machine.
Yeah.
But you see, this is exactly what made, I think, the movie so great, was because it's a continuous chase from the beginning
until
to
the
end.
Right.
And you never know who to trust, who is his ally, and later on when we get to Mars, you will see. I mean, it is like, you know, everything is a question and you can never trust anyone.
This is a real location, really. This is in the underground of Mexico City. This is a scene we had basically on the escalator here, where we had real problems with the MPAA, because the original version of that was pretty, well, it's brutal still, but it was more brutal before.
Yeah, I like that.
It's horrible yeah. because he used him as a human shield.
Exactly. Well, what else are you going to do under the circumstances? I continuously used him as a human shield, and then I threw him down the escalator.
Little detail I added.
Yeah. No regard for human life or death.
Well, it's the villain, isn't it? Remember this scene, basically, you cut your hand there terribly.
Yeah, this is right there,
on
exactly.
On that chart,
yeah.
Basically,
yeah.
Basically, you had to stitch it on the stent.
Right, right, right.
The doctor had to come in.
Yeah, well, because you remember that before I hit the glass, it's supposed to explode.
Right.
And we had an explosion, and it didn't explode, and so I hit the real glass
right.
and cut myself.
Yeah, and
course.
Then it exploded as you did a fraction of a second too late, didn't it?
Exactly, and I remember very well that... it was just half an hour before lunch break, and then I went to the trailer, got stitched up quickly,
right.
and then after lunch we continued shooting the same scene
right.
again.
Right.
I want that fucker dead.
I don't blame him, man. I wouldn't want a guy like Quaid porking my old lady.
You saying she likes it?
No, I'm sure she hated every minute of it.
He's teasing him a little bit,
exactly.
trying to tell... to tell him that it was a great that Arnold had a great time with his lorry. Now the guy we have seen before in the first scene on the television, isn't it? Turns out to be the supervillain. This is Ronnie Cox again, who I used as the corporate villain in RoboCop.
Delivered a lie for reimplantation. Have you got that? I want him back in place with Lori. Did you hear me?
Sunspots.
What was that, sir? I couldn't hear you.
They just want to kill him, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, they don't want him in place. They're subversive to their... because apparently Michael Ironside doesn't want Laurie at all anymore with Quaid, isn't it? It's been too long already.
She enjoyed it too much.
Yeah, right. So basically, they have their own agenda to kill him. While Cohagen still has this original plan, which we'll reveal much later, which has to do with the original... let's say, persona of Quaid at the time that he was living on Mars, which must have been, let's say, a year ago or something like that.
How we doing?
Fine. We're zooming in.
So this was the interesting thing, is because they could always track me. And we find out then later on of how I can get rid of that problem.
Yeah, somehow they can track him, but you don't know why they can.
You don't know why, no, exactly. But
because
we
his
find
own
out.
Where is this
exactly.
machine? Where is this little thing that they basically, that they must have hidden in his clothes or
right,
shoes
right.
or whatever? Now, this is a typical Philip Dick situation. Now, the person has no clues anymore. He doesn't know where to go. He doesn't know where he's coming from, even. And suddenly somebody makes a phone call and says, "Hey, I'm here to help you." And what we, of course, but he doesn't realize that in his former life, he left clues that would be helpful to him now. So the former persona of Quaid later turns out to be Hauser, but the former persona of Quaid apparently made plans for what would happen after the implant.
Right, and now he just got the message that he should actually put a wet towel around his
which
head.
Which is also like crazy.
Exactly, yeah, so that they
because
cannot...
Still don't know.
So they cannot detect of where I am. I run around like an Indian.
Can you see me down here?
Mm-hmm. That is the, that's the, let's say, a big, some big briefcase or whatever you would call it, box, that seems to be very important, but it is, of course, all the clues that, A, he needs to survive or to continue his adventure. For us, it's a clue, really, to keep the narrative going, isn't it?
That's a funny scene. She's trying to steal the suitcase.
Yeah, poor homeless woman thinks that she has a good day, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
We discussed a lot of it. It was nice enough for the character to do, isn't it? to do that against an old lady.
A little Paul Verhoeven style there. You see, now they have problems following it because of the wet towel around.
Yeah, so that makes it somehow unclear.
It works a little bit until it dries out, of course, the towel. Then I'm in trouble again.
Hello, I'm Johnny Cat. Where can I take you tonight?
Oh, this scene is unbelievable because my frustration about this taxi cab does not understand where I want to go.
Just go, go! Please state your street and number.
Shit.
I'm not familiar with that address. Would you please repeat that information?
This was shot in the center of Mexico City in a little mall. I mean, it's a round circle that's a little bit below the normal level of the road. So you can rotate around as much as you want there. Because it's a circular thing.
Again, I got away. So now they're totally steaming.
And here he goes. This is an old cement factory, also in Mexico City, so it's a real location.
The fare is 18 credits, please.
Sue me, dickhead.
We needed that explosion so that later they can say, oh, there was an explosion in the old cement factory.
And they showed the heat.
Right, exactly. So they found something and that's why they come to this location, yeah. Otherwise they would never be there, of
we
course.
We have no idea what was in that cap that was so explosive.
Right.
But it exploded anyway.
Right.
Yeah.
So now he gets, for the first time he has time to reflect, I would say. This is a moment of isolation where, after removing the rats, he can put start to take the things out that he had planned for himself. Realizing that at a certain moment, after whatever happened to him, after whatever they did to his brain, that he might need that basically to fulfill his mission. His mission was supposed to be positive. He thinks that we find out that looks like it is a positive mission against to help the guerrillas. Ultimately, it turns out to be a negative mission to infiltrate the guerrillas, but he doesn't know that.
Now he realizes that there's a hologram of him.
That little machine that he has, that we will use in the latter part of the movie, isn't it? When in the final act, in the last 10-15 minutes, he uses the hologram. So it was just a device. I don't know if it's a device of Philip Dick. It might be a device of the original writers or of Gary Goldman. I forgot that, to add that to the content of the box. And here, basically, something interesting comes out that is a message to himself.
Howdy, stranger. This is Hauser. If things have gone wrong, I'm talking to myself and you've got a wet towel wrapped around your head. Now, whatever your name is,
so this seems to be his friend, isn't it?
Right.
I mean, in fact, it's himself
setting
up, explaining the big plan. What we don't realize, and we'll realize much, much later, is that this is Hauser.
Right.
That this is the bad guy.
It's not Quaid, it's Hauser. That's
I mean, Hauser and Quaid are the same, but it's the incarnation Hauser.
Right.
And Hauser is working for Cohagen.
And now he's telling him that he has to take the bug out of his nose, which is this gross scene. Remember, everyone was grossed out. Me putting this thing my nose.
A woman. And I learned a few things. Like, I've been playing for the wrong team. All I can do now is try to make up for it.
So he tells him here that he worked in some way, because he knows that will be discovered, that he was working for Cohagen, but that he changed his mind, isn't it? That, of course, is a lie.
Right.
And here comes the hard part.
But, of course, as this is all the information that you here, to say the now Quaid has, he believes it, of course.
So that's basically how they detected where I am, because they saw the fire, it shows up.
Yeah.
It's a heat-seeking device.
Let's get rid of the bug in your head. Take this thing out of the case and stick it up your nose. Don't worry, it's self-guiding.
Oh, that's so unbelievable.
Just shove real hard.
There's one, one or two, this is all real, of course.
Crunch, you're there.
Still real.
Be careful. It's my head, too.
And this, of course, you cannot see, so well done, isn't it, this?
Yeah.
But that was a puppet, isn't it?
Yeah, that was the bug that was inside my nose. And that's why they always could find me. So
again, these shots that where you see the last shot where he pulls it out and the nose and all that stuff was
a puppet.
Was a puppet. Although nowadays we would probably do that digitally, isn't it?
Right. But I mean, it was totally believable.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, you did not
see
that it was a puppet.
Well, there were 10 puppeteers, I think, and we did it after shooting the movie because it was so complicated.
Yeah.
To get these two shots took us 2 days, I think. To get all the grimaces of the skin and all that stuff and the eyes working together was really difficult. And then here we had the little device there, because ultimately there was a scene where he would go to Mars and sit in a rocket, spaceships, and that would bring him to Mars. But ultimately there was not enough money to do that scene, in fact, and I'm not even sure that it was so important. So we found this little trick that the scene ends up with get your ass to Mars. And by repeating that, we made a very fast transition from going from Earth to Mars.
Right. Yeah, because we had to cut out the spaceship because of budget reasons, right?
Right, yeah.
Yeah. Now here they are following, I put that little device that was in my nose, I put in the chocolate, gave it to the rat, and the rat is now running around with that device. But they don't know, they think that I'm right there, they are on my track.
Give me that! Get your ass to Mars. 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 Get your ass to Mars.
I think it works very well.
Yes.
It's cruel. So we can nearly cut out all the stuff in between, isn't it?
Right.
And we immediately go to Mars here. This was one of the miniature shots that was, and this one too, of course, that was done in... by DreamQuest, under the supervision of Erik Brevik, who later went to ILM and, for example, just finished, was the supervisor on a lot of movies like Men in Black and recently on Pearl Harbor. So he did all the miniatures and all the kind of what you would call the special effect work, with the exception of the things that were done by Rob Bottin, like the scene with the puppets, basically, like taking the thing out of your nose and all that.
This is a wonderful scene where I come up to Mars as an old lady, as a fat old lady.
It's called in the script the Fat Lady, and we gave her this kind of yellow, strange yellow colored thing.
Exactly. And I'm actually hiding underneath this thing, which is the amazing thing which we find out later on.
This is, of course, something we built. It served several purposes. First, to show how he escaped basically from Earth without being recognized or being holed up in the space station by hiding inside this kind of construction, this woman. Secondary to bring Michael Ironside back into the picture, because he apparently was on the same spaceship. And thirdly, very importantly, it was about showing that there was no air on Mars, that outside all the buildings there is a vacuum. Go ahead.
I just want to say that now things are going wrong with the phase. The uncontrollable distortion of the face and everything, and that's what busts me actually right now. Because the face does not stop and it says the wrong things all the time.
Which is partially still the woman doing it, isn't it? I mean, the actress doing this.
Right. This is still the actress, but then we are cutting now from here on, I think it is now a puppet. No, this is still her.
Where? The woman! Get him! Her!
Arrest that woman! Get that woman!
And now I'm turning something here. And now this is our puppet.
Ready for a surprise.
I think this is a fantastic scene, you know.
Yeah.
Of what a surprise, you know, to come up there as an old lady, then all of a sudden the thing malfunctions and they catch me, and then of course this is not just a face or a head, it's also an explosive device.
Right.
It's all part of that big roller coaster ride.
So this is just also to prove that outside, as I said, there is vacuum, isn't it? Which is so important for later, for basically solving the end of the movie, where it's all about basically providing air to the planet.
Do you remember how long it took us to shoot this thing with the green screen and blue screen?
To get everybody, to get you in a completely horizontal position.
Right.
Because you're hanging on wires here partially, and I think part of the shots are done we did it later, with a kind of a, where we brought the set under 90 degrees.
Right.
It? So you used gravity to get you in a horizontal then position.
Open the goddamn door!
I can't!
Open it!
They're all connected!
Here we introduce, through the windows, we'll shortly introduce this kind of strange mountain that you see there in the distance, and that has a kind of a pyramid form. Originally, that was supposed to be the face on Mars, and that some people said was discovered. I always felt that that was probably not, that it was kind of a fantasy thing, and I felt that it was better to do it with something that was a bit more neutral. This is a special effect shot where the little thing in the window is printed into this miniature shot. So the shot of Arnold and the guy is real, but we printed that, in the window of the train. And this shot, we still have to thank you, Arnold, because originally this last shot with the train was completely taken out of the production because they felt it was too expensive. And then basically you talked to them and they gave it back to us, isn't it?
Exactly. But I have to tell you one thing, that looking at this, every time I look at this film, I have to say that the visual effects was so spectacular. It was like the state of the art at that time.
Right.
You know, it was really like, we had the best people working on it, the most talented crew working on it to create all the visual effects and special effects.
And especially in scenes like this, they was a horrible task they had. Because the problem was, of course, the background, of course, is really, you see things moving there in the background. So it's all miniatures and partially it's matte paintings and whatever. But it had all to be red.
Right.
But when we shot it, it would be blue screen. So the let's say the reflections on the people had to be red. But the blue screen had to be blue, of course.
Yeah.
So the DP had a horrible job that to get red reflections on the faces while the light was coming from the outside was all blue.
Exactly. Yeah, I remember exactly several times when I worked with various different objects. We had to reshoot it again because there was on a chrome part of that drilling device into the nose was, for instance, a blue reflection,
right.
which we detected in the dailies.
Right.
So we had to do it again and get a different reflection on
that. It was very hard with this so-called red light that we wanted because everybody thinks about Mars as being something that has a red light, isn't it? And the planet seems to be a reddish. So we didn't want to give that up, but it was a horror job, basically, for the special effect people. And I have a plan to keep this. Because we used throughout when we could. We wanted windows so we would see the outside, and all the buildings are kind of built in the canyons of Mars.
Mm.
Which was an idea that we got from NASA, in fact. NASA said one of the ways to build there would be to do it in the canyons, because then in the canyons you would be better protected against radiation from space, because the light would not reach you directly, would be broken, and then ultimately, of course, the radiation from space is a very important issue of the movie, because it is, which you would call it nowadays, an environmental issue. The fact that these domes were built in a certain way, that they did not give enough protection against the radiation is the reason that you have mutants on Mars. I mean, basically our discussion nowadays, especially since Bush came to power, is about these environmental issues, about how much danger is there, for example, if we have no ozone layer anymore, or if there are holes in the ozone layer. And that has a little bit to do with this idea where it is about the construction of the domes is faulty. And Cohagen used not enough money to make good domes, with the result that the protection of the people was flawed. And as a result of that, people became mutants. That's the thematic material of the movie, I think. I mean, from the narrative point of view, clearly.
And mutants we have. I mean, later on we will see some extraordinary mutants, all specially created by you, Paul.
Yeah.
Especially the ones with the three breasts.
Yeah, that was my favorite. I think I invented that, yeah. This is also such a great scene where he thinks that he discovers or is going to find something really important, and he finds his little flyer describing a sex club, isn't it? It's always the way it was done, and I think a lot of these things were added by Gary Goldman, that we would go one direction and think, okay, this is going to be an important clue, and ultimately you find out that it is something like, what, is this a clue? Do I have to go to a sex club?
Hey man, you need a cab?
We used a lot of rocks inside the shots, between the walls and all that stuff. So that you could get the feeling that it was all underneath, built in the canyons, kind of. This is really just to introduce a little bit the guerrilla warfare, that you would call it, that's happening on Mars, where the government, the Cohagen government, is suppressing, repressing, you could say, the voices of freedom that are coming from the guerrillas.
Get out of here! Before they arrest us!
Well, what did the rebels want?
Usual, more money, more freedom, more air.
Don't speak about.
So, where to?
Last resort.
You're getting off to an early start.
So this is a kind of our version of the Martian red light district of Amsterdam. I think where we're going to.
And the red light district it is. Here's the mole, the famous mole, remember that?
Yeah, right, yeah, but yeah, that was to introduce it here so we can use it later for the scene where it attacks you, isn't it?
I love that mole, how it digs in, a few hundred yards below the ground, it goes right through and makes the new, areas where you can just, you can go from one spot to the next just drilling through the walls.
And here's one of the mutants in it. Basically, that's start to introduce the theme of why are there mutants there, what is their function, and ultimately what, how did it come, how did mutants appear in the first place? Why are there so many
such
these four?
Sick-looking people, huh? She was a cutie.
This was basically the team of the mutants was supposed to be in Total Recall 2, remember that, Arnold?
Right, right.
But the other Philip Dick story that was originally called Minority Report, that is done by Spielberg now, as you might have noticed.
Very much so. Thank you.
But that was our Total Recall 2 story, because the mutants, there was an introduction here already that they are kind of clairvoyant, perhaps, in it, that they can see certain things, and that was used in the second one, was used where you become the head of this company that can look in the future and just protect the citizens by eliminating criminals before they do a crime.
Before they do the crime, exactly.
Yeah. This is kind of a cross between kind of a bordello, kind of bar, whatever, isn't it?
What do you want?
I'm looking for Melina.
Well, she's busy.
I mean, so basically busy and free, meaning prostitution, clearly.
She has three breasts, huh? That's the one with the three breasts.
Right. Oh. Yeah, her real breasts are, it's not that we added one breast, we Robotine made something that fitted over her two breasts,
right.
But were three breasts, so the whole thing is a kind of a prosthetic, clearly.
Right, right.
Mel! Hey, Mel!
Hey. So this must be something out of the past, isn't it? He doesn't remember, but she remembers him as being, as we understand, Hauser, one way or the other. This is Marshall Bell there, who is the head of the guerrillas, but we don't know that. These are all people that are, let's say, part of the revolutionary movement that is against dictator, I would call him, Dictator Cohagen, isn't it?
Right, right. So you don't think that I have no idea who she is? Or
there
that
might be a vague memory that
yeah, because
you say.
That's the way I played it, I remember. Yeah. I played it that it somehow.
A little déjà vu.
Something, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, but not without having any idea, really. Because
that's right.
I mean,
you got a lot of nerve showing your face around here, Hauser.
Look who's talking.
I mean, they all, of course, all the people of the guerrilla movement are very wary of where Hauser stands, isn't it?
Yeah.
They see this guy coming back that they know as an agent of Cohagen, but perhaps why is he here? Did he change his mind? Is he on the other side? Is he now willing to be on our side? And she has to, being one of the top agents, let's say, being in the disguise of a prostitute, but clearly this kind of whole pseudo-bordello is nothing else than the hangout of the revolutionary movement.
I thought the Cohagen tortured you to death.
I guess he didn't.
And you couldn't get me a message?
So I'm totally shocked now at this point here, because I do remember, I'm aware of something, but I don't know who she is or anything like that. And all of a sudden I walk into her room and she smacks me across the face.
Then she starts to kiss you all over the place.
And then she complains, why haven't you come back and where have you been and look at me and what about me and all this. And then she kisses me.
I don't remember you.
What are you talking about?
I don't remember you. I don't remember us. I don't even remember me.
What did you get, amnesia? How did you get here?
Hauser left me a note.
Hauser, your Hauser.
So there's something dawns on him, at least to the degree that he seems to have been Hauser before.
Right, right.
That's kind of clear to him now, and she knows him as Hauser, but ultimately they have suppressed the memories about her, are completely suppressed, isn't it?
Right, right.
Nobody else. Me.
This is too weird.
And he dumped me on Earth with a wife and a lousy child.
Did you say wife? Are you fucking married?
Now you get the kind of jealousy
exactly.
Scene.
Exactly.
So it goes into, let's say, soap
everything.
Opera melodrama here for a moment.
Goddamn lies.
Why would I lie to you?
Because you're still working for Cohagen.
Don't be ridiculous.
But basically, we cannot go too far, so she has to break off the scene, narrative-wise, because otherwise too much information would become clear, so it has to stop nearly, and she stops him by moving him out of the room with a gun, isn't it?
Right.
Because he wants more information, isn't it?
Well, she works for the underground, for the
right.
rebels.
Yes.
Get out.
You got to help me remember.
I said get out.
Yelena, please. People are trying to kill me.
Really?
So basically, in fact, what we're doing here, narrative-wise, is to stop the source of information, kind of, isn't it? So
yeah.
that we are left in dubio exactly what's happening.
Right.
So we introduce Benny here, the cab driver, as somebody that is a very nice guy and has is looking for work because he has just a big family, and he seems to be an okay guy. One of
right.
these other persons that is not exactly what he seems to be, isn't it? And then we have here an eye contact between between Melina and Marshall Bell, who is, as I said, the head of the guerrilla movement.
Right.
A reintroduction for Quaid of Cohagen. And now we come to a very important, from a, let's say, we say philosophical point of view, a very important scene, which is the appearance of a recall operator, say. Somebody that works for the company that did the original implant.
Right, that we have seen actually on the screen before.
In the underground,
exactly.
Right. I was looking, when I was casting this, I was looking for somebody that would look a little, let's say, naive and strange and a bit weird in the way his clothes are, his face are. In fact, I was looking for a strong man, but you only start to realize that later in the scene. As you had this professor in Torn Curtain in the Hitchcock movie,
right.
where basically the medical event Paul Newman goes to the eastern part of Europe to get secrets. And I try to, there's a very great part there in that movie, which is the professor that has the secrets, the mathematical secrets that Paul Newman, who is also a professor, tries to get. And I wanted Edgemar to be a little bit like that. I mean, there's a lot of Hitchcockian stuff there. There was the low angles that you had there when the story, to give a feeling, showing a lot of ceilings and all that stuff. So
right.
to give a feeling of disturbance and things that are unclear. What the reality of it is. Because he is telling him that everything, from the moment that he entered basically into the recall machine, is an implant. And everything we have seen before, in the last 45 minutes, is all fantasy. It's a dream. Which is very disturbing to the audience, because they don't want that, of course. They want an adventure story, and they don't want a fake adventure story.
Yeah.
So I think they are on Arnold's side, on your side, trying to believe that it was all true, while he is trying to convince Quaid that it's not true.
I like that turn now, when I'm trying to figure out if he's lying or not. When I tell him, well, then you're not really here.
Right.
And you're not real.
And yeah, then she comes with convincing proof, basically his wife being sweet and not at all the secret agent that
That's
she was
right.
before, isn't it? I mean, we must assume that these things are happening, if we believe what Edgemar is saying, that these things are happening in the recall office still, isn't it?
You're not here either.
So there, he brings in now, as an additional tool to convince Arnold Quaid that he is still living in a dream, he brings in his wife, that seems to be a sweetheart here, very charming, and is also supposed to help him to get out of this psychosis that has caught him in the recall offices. So we must imagine that both of them, Laurie and Dr. Edgemar, have been brought into the office of recall, which we saw in the very beginning on Earth, to convince him to listen to the help that the company sends out, which is Edgemar, with the pill that we see later, to bring him back to reality. On the meantime, and here another kind of Hitchcockian situation, like these high angles and low angles using all the time, but Edgemar is trying to tell him that he should listen and take the pill and go back to reality. On the other hand, of course, it could well be that this is all a trick of Cohagen to give him a pill that poisons him, or in whatever way brings him, basically makes him captive of the Cohagen government.
It's a symbol of your desire to return to reality. Inside your dream, you'll fall asleep.
The great thing is she plays it totally vulnerable and helpful.
Right.
And
yeah, she's just really
convince me.
Right.
To go his way, take this pill, and everything will be fine, and we'll be happily married after.
And it's interesting that Edgemar here, when you listen to him, seems not to be A, afraid of the gun, because for him it's not a real gun, of course, it's
right.
A dream gun. But he tells you the whole story again, as it's going to develop now.
Right.
The walls of reality will break apart because the walls of the room will basically be blown out in the next 10 seconds.
Right, exactly.
And all these things he's saying, alien civilization, will happen, of course. Also, the fact that he is Cohagen's, that he is a friend of the guerrillas, and I mean that he's helping the guerrillas, but the next moment he will be a buddy of Cohagen. It all will happen in the next 15, 20 minutes. So again, like in the beginning of the story, we tell you the whole narrative of the third act, in fact.
And here's the great moment of the sweat running down, which gives it away.
Go ahead,
watch this. With the sweat running down, and that gives it away that he is afraid. And it is...
That is acting, what he's doing.
He is acting, yeah. And it is not real. Here it is.
Or you could argue that in his dream, because he wants to stay within his dream, he cannot get out of his dream anymore. The one they sent in to help him, basically, that you invented yourself this transpiration on the head, isn't it?
Right.
So that to convince yourself that it would be that you had to kill him.
So here's the big fight scene where I broke my finger, remember?
Yeah, and you had to do the rest of the movie exactly. with a cast around your thumb all
exactly.
the time. I mean, I think we kept it out of frame most of the time.
Yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
This is great, isn't it, here? This kind of diabolical sweetness of her.
Yeah.
I mean, this turnaround from sweetie to the ultimate devil, isn't it?
Oh, she can snap. I mean, she can be as sweet and vulnerable and engaging.
I mean, that basically, especially in the next scene where she, when Melina appears and you see the change of mind of her when she becomes, from the diabolical person, goes back into full charm.
Exactly.
That was really the moment that later, when I was doing Basic Instinct, I thought, perhaps she can do that.
Oh, yeah. Well,
perhaps
yeah,
she
yeah.
can really play this woman, let's say, Catherine Tremel, by using... because Catherine Tremel is also going up and down between charm and diabolical, isn't it?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that she is perfect for the role and was perfect for the role.
So now, we asked Vic Armstrong to do here a real, let's say, not a cat fight, but a real, say, martial arts kind of situation.
Yeah, exactly.
So that it would not be these two, that the two women would be two warriors. That's one of the first times I think that two women are fighting each other here in a kind of a, let's say, a normal way, isn't it? With according to
the way women would fight, yeah.
Instead of pulling hairs or all that stuff.
Exactly,
stretching.
Yeah.
Fuck you!
She really enjoys that kind of stuff.
Oh,
yeah,
she loves it, yeah.
Well, look here. This is what I mean.
Doug. Honey. You wouldn't hurt me.
There she is, isn't it? Go
yeah, again.
Makes the transition in
snaps
4 seconds.
2 seconds, exactly.
Here's
it already with the gun. Here's the gun coming out.
We're married.
But that was, I mean, that was always the moment that later made me think... Gee, if she can do that, but she can do here in 4 seconds, if she can do it in 2 hours.
Oh, yeah, but I love that line when I say here, consider it a
divorce.
Divorce,
yeah.
Yeah, great, great line.
That was a line that, I think Gary Goldman added that to the script.
Yeah. This is one of the famous one-liners of mine.
Yeah, it's near on the level of I'll be back.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Consider it a divorce. And what a terrific line.
Apologize.
Now we introduce something or reintroduce something, the name Quato, that you have heard in the very first part of the movie at the news, where the Quato is mentioned as the head of the guerrilla movement, but we don't know where he is and what he is.
What I like also about the film is in the way you directed it is that every time when they come out, the villains, I just a tenth of a second before it disappeared into the elevator or somewhere,
right,
that we almost run into each other.
Right, right,
so it always keeps the tension. Would it get me or not?
He knows that basically he bluffs, he feels
exactly,
great that he cannot shoot because it's too
dangerous.
Blows
out the glass and it blows him out of the out of that structure too.
But Ironside, who just lost the love of his life, say is not worth is shooting anyhow. But his second in command, sidekick, really prevents further damage there, isn't it?
Right.
Later, of course, the blowing of the. Of let's say the windows being blown to pieces is part of the third act. It's all preparation for that. And here Benny pops up again, who still seems to be on the good side, but coincidentally
he always
there.
Happens to be there,
right.
No matter how much I escape, right. He happens to be there.
But he might have been arranged by Cohagen to be there and to pick him up. In this so-called chase that we have here, I think we had a little corridor that was not longer than 30 yards in it. So all these shots are done in the same area all the time.
Over and over,
that's
we went
we
back
had,
and forth.
That's
exactly.
That you saw there, that's
yeah,
what we
30
had.
Yards we had. And remember, they built that outside of the studio on the side.
From one studio to the other.
Exactly.
Yeah, they connected two studios because they... again, for reasons of economy, they didn't want to give us more of a more tunnel.
No, I know. And we spent endless amount of time in there inhaling that dust.
Ah, this
remember
is horrible,
the finest dust,
right.
Very dangerous for the lungs.
Is it?
Oh yeah. Funny. They would never catch up with us.
What? Oh, Christ! Now they're after me!
Realize that Benny is still playing the good guy, isn't it, here?
Right.
Now they're back into the right red light district, and basically go back to the hangout of the guerrillas, which is their so-called headquarters, and then one of the mutants, of course, is helping them to escape. The mutant situation, of course, being connected with the guerrillas, is because of the mutants are the ones that most suffered because of the bad government of Cohagen, isn't it? The bad government of Cohagen providing or making these domes that are really not protecting the people.
Hey, you wanna have some fun?
Where are they?
What are you talking about? I don't know.
So that's could be come from some.
I love it.
Oh, it is like, fascist movie, I would
it's
say.
One thing. It's one thing to shoot somebody.
But
it's another thing to shoot them in the back, and it's another thing to shoot a woman in the back.
A woman with three breasts.
It's three breasts, exactly. That was great.
It's unbelievable.
I love that fight scene there. It was just so well orchestrated.
Yeah.
And so well
also
choreographed.
Also a lot of second units by Vic Armstrong here. And he was a great second unit director, you know, worked a lot for Spielberg and other people.
Right.
He can rely absolutely on him and basically can give him a whole part of scenes so that he will do that exactly the way you want it, or even better, clearly, because he's so talented, really. Again, now we emphasize a little bit on the background of the shots here of Richter. The rotation there is, of course, has a lot to do with the air, isn't it? That starts to become more and more important in the next part of the movie. So we start to emphasize it as much as we can, because that's the direction that the story will go, the absence or the presence of air. Because Cohagen is basically going to kill all these people, and, you know, because he realizes that the insurrectionists are kind of in that part of the area, and so he just decides to suffocate them.
Right.
So basically, although he will kill a lot of innocent people at the same time, he would probably call that, to quote McVeigh, collateral damage.
Or to quote our movie.
Yeah, that's true.
Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot.
Again, trying to connect the mutancy, killing dead bodies and all that stuff with absence or presence of air, isn't it? And more and more emphasizing the theme of the air, but ultimately is supposed to be something that will be provided to the planet Mars by an alien reactor that is built inside the mountain. If you follow the version that it's all real.
Right,
If it's, of course, a dream, then it's just all nonsense, isn't it? The alien reactors are nonsense, and that's a construction that was provided by the recall operation, and was even mentioned and told to us by Dr. Esmar. This is, of course, the area where we constructed there. It's like the Roman catacombs, isn't it, where they buried the Christians and all that stuff.
Right, right.
So it's again the Christians being hiding for the Roman Empire. Is a kind of a metaphor for the guerrillas hiding for Cohagen. Now Benny turns has a new secret we find from Benny, that is this was done by Rob Bottin, all the alien stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And Benny is now even more, before we discover that he is on the other side, we try to make him even more so a hero of the guerrilla side, isn't it? By showing that he is as much a victim of Cohagen, of the bad domes that he constructed Cohagen, as the other mutants.
You wait here. Follow me.
Won't do any good. Cohagen pressurized the tunnels.
Then drill through to section M.
We can't. We're running out of air. We need help.
Okay, sit tight. Melina just got here with Quade.
I hope it was worth it.
Marshall Bell, I'm used again as the cowardly general in Starship Troopers, in fact.
Cohagen sealed up Venusville. He shut up the air.
Was killed by Burke falling on top of him.
He wants you. If we don't hand you over, everybody in the sector will be dead by morning.
Well, then we don't have much choice, do we?
Again, of course, this is clearly all location, all shot in Cherubusco Studios.
Wait.
And this is one shot to prepare us for something that is tricky about Benny.
Sit down.
And now we get the reveal of Quato. That was a very original idea. I'm not even sure that it is in the Philip Dick story anymore. I didn't reread it. But the idea of Quato being a part of Marshall Bell, being like a twin of Marshall Bell let's say, part of his own body, I think is an original idea of Dan O'Bannon and Ron Suchet, in my opinion. I don't think that's in the original story. You know that sometimes people are born that have parts of limbs, Siamic twins, isn't it? And sometimes there is people are born that have perhaps even two arms sticking out of stuff that was a part of the X of the female egg cell that split up to a certain degree, but never came to become a twin.
Right,
it's like a rudimentary twin, really. The construction, of course, is from Rob Bottin, and it's all puppets engineered. There are about 15, 20 puppeteers to do arms, fingers, eyeballs, cheeks, the frowning of the head, all done by different puppeteers. The chest of Marshall Bell is fake, of course, so we built a whole body, a new chest, plus this little being Quato. We built that on Marshall Bell. Very difficult because it took 6 hours or 4 or 5 hours to build it on his body, but you couldn't go to the restroom.
Right.
And then he still had to shoot 5 hours.
It was tough for him to go to his makeup job.
It was horrible.
I mean, I can relate to it because I've gone through it and the Conan movies,
right.
And then Terminator, and of course on Batman and Robin.
You cannot drink, isn't it?
Oh, it's like terrible. And you can't go to the bathroom. You just have to, you know, really discipline yourself. You can't move around much, and you hang there every day 5 hours on a makeup chair.
Right.
Open your mind. Open your mind.
This is what you see here later turns out to be the, let's say, the bars.
The rods. The
rods,
exactly, yeah.
Of the nuclear reactor.
The nuclear reactor, exactly. Yeah, I remember that.
Originally, there was a design by Ron Cobb who made a big, let's say, sphere-like a thing that basically would be standing in a cave, and that would be the machine. But we felt, ultimately, that it had to be something gigantic. Is it something that would be like a sea of rods?
Right.
That would stretch out as far as the eye goes to make a bit more convincing that the air of Mars could be produced in a couple of minutes, isn't it?
Right.
Which is, of course, nonsense in the first place, but we try to make that as believable as possible. These, of course, which is still unknown here, these columns that you see here are, in fact, the rods that a nuclear reactor would have, isn't
right.
it? Only not on that scale, of course, but this is an alien civilization that
exactly,
built that.
Yeah.
So it's much bigger than anything that any nuclear reactor that is on Earth, but a nuclear reactor has these rods.
And here's the big, the hand.
So it's like kind of the only flashback in the whole movie where you get something out of the past, isn't it?
Wake up! Come on. Here the mole is coming.
Yeah, moles are used by Cohagen now for
To travel underground to get anywhere to any enemy.
And get anywhere where
you
want to be. And now they have, of course, through perhaps a device that Benny has with him, the Cohagen has found out what the headquarters of the guerrillas are, and now he is let's say attacking, and is going to kill. I mean, this is a big coup for Cohagen because he has located through Quaid, through Benny, basically by Benny following Quaid. Benny, of course, has been able somehow with some electronic device to warn Cohagen that this is where the headquarters are, isn't it? Because Benny is at the headquarters.
Right.
So all the people that
there's
were...
There's a huge shootout.
Yeah.
We shot it for days, the scene there.
Yeah, again...
From every angle. And,
right.
Or then the second unit came in and shot...
For days again.
Yeah, for days again, exactly.
Right.
Yeah, because every one of those guys, you know, had to be made up with a... It explosions, so you can see the hits when it hit the bullets hit the bodies and all that stuff.
So this is then the turnaround, isn't it?
Yeah.
Benny, hurry.
He just shoots him because he doesn't need him anymore. Right. And it's all about Quaid now, because Quaid is going to be Hauser again, isn't it? Quaid is brought to Cohagen, and basically then will be brought back to what he was before.
Secret agent.
Right.
That infiltrates.
Yeah, he has basically reached his goal, isn't it? I mean, through Kuwait, they have already destroyed most of the operation now of the guerrillas. I mean, he's kind of an innocent... He basically, without knowing it, he has led them to the underground movement.
Forget it, man. His fortune-telling days are over. Start the reactor. Remar.
This was a shot that Frank Uriosti always felt should not have been in the movie. That last close-up of you.
Why not?
Well, he thought it was better to cut away after the line.
Uh-huh.
Later, when he saw the movie, he told me... Because I said to him, perhaps we should not use that shot. And he said, no, we have to use it. But later, years later, he said, oh, I saw it on television. You were right. That shot should not have been there.
Funny.
We should, after the line of Michael Ironside, we should have immediately cut to the body on the dead body of Quato. So now we get basically the story, going and explains really that there is much more to the story than anticipated. This move, let's say this narrative move, where we not only because we have already found out that basically that Hauser was perhaps partially had been working for Cohagen, but had changed his mind and had become part of the guerrilla movement, isn't it? Before they transported him to Earth. Now we find out that that never happened. That Hauser was always on the wrong side. And it was just Cohagen who had changed Hauser into Quaid to seduce the guerrillas to accept Quaid as one of them. Quaid, of course, has nothing to do with all that, you know, basically, because he's a different person than Hauser. It's two minds living in the same body, isn't it?
Well, I always felt that it was actually, that it was Hauser in reality. And then when I went in and infiltrated into the resistance movement,
right,
I realized...
That they were right.
That they were actually right. And that the evil empire was wrong.
No, that's what I mean.
Yeah, exactly. Make the switch. And
make
they decided
switch,
to
yeah.
make the switch. And they, of course, are totally taken by surprise
right.
with that switch.
Oh. Don't take my word for it. Someone you trust wants to talk to you.
Who is it this time? My mother?
Howdy, Quaid. Now, if you're listening to this, that means that Quato is dead and you have led us to him.
So now it turns out that that's what he thought was before,
exactly.
And what would be a great guy
yeah.
is that he had been a great guy. It turns out that he was a drunk, that he was a bad guy.
Totally bad, yeah.
What I want to say is that that part of the narrative, that little twist, was something that Gary Goldman added to the story.
Right.
Because that was never there before. That it was more, let's say, one-dimensional. It was more like, okay, he was somebody that perhaps was seduced to become part of the guerrilla movement, like you just said, isn't it? And that was it. But now it turns out that was also a trick, of course.
That was a great shot in the end when they show me and
when
him
together there,
exactly. Yeah. And us both together watching it. Now we're going back on the recall chair.
And now he will be forced to become the person he doesn't want to be, isn't it?
Right.
Because he has made a moral choice. With the new personality, he has been able to make a moral choice, isn't it? And realize that the personality he had before was not something he enjoys.
They're trying to deprogram her now and make her part of the evil empire.
Yeah. It's the last thing that he wants is to go back to Hauser.
No, he doesn't want to.
It's a kind of interesting philosophical thing.
Absolutely, yeah.
It would be nice if in life you could make such sharp decisions, isn't it? I mean, we're always much more ambivalent, I think, in real life about the moral choices we make.
You like being Hauser.
Guy's a fucking asshole.
Not true. He's one of my best friends. Besides, he's got a big house and a Mercedes. And you like Melina, right? Well, you get to fuck her every night. That's right. She's going to be Hauser's babe.
It's horrible, this Cohagen, isn't it? Uh-huh, princess. I mean, if they would be succeed in doing this memory implant, of course he would be happy, isn't it?
Right. Because he wouldn't know that he was... No, exactly. But he don't know
that.
It's
the most horrible thing. They can say, we're going to make you happy, but everything you think now, you cannot think anymore.
Right, right.
Yes, what is it?
Sir, the oxygen level is bottoming out in Sector G. What do you want me to do about it?
Don't do anything.
But they won't last an hour, sir.
Fuck them. Listen to the others.
Come on, Cohagan, you got what you want. Give these people air.
My friend, in 5 minutes, you won't give a shit about the people.
Well, that's kind of an interesting statement, isn't it?
Right.
Politically, basically, when you have another other glasses on, basically, you will look at it's like, it's really talking about imperialism, fascism, or whatever. Whatever you're seduced to become, that's what you believe, isn't it?
Right.
Oh, Quaid. I'm having a party tonight. Why don't you and Melina drop by? Remind him, Doc?
Oh,
sure.
That's
so funny, isn't it? Because it would all be true, isn't it? He would go to the party.
He would.
Yeah, he would be happy and think, I did a good job. I heard that they would say, you did a really good job. He wouldn't even remember, isn't it?
Right.
Keep still. Fighting just makes it hurt.
Of course, there's a lot of resemblance to the machine in the recall room, isn't it?
Absolutely, exactly, yeah.
You don't keep still, you'll end up psychotic.
Oh, yeah, that's a classic movement.
It's like a robot. You're a robot now, isn't it?
Yeah.
With the steel arm. It's a kind of really Terminator scene, this, I think. Well, we had to cut a little bit in that scene for the FDA, because these shots were a little bit longer.
Yeah, much longer. I remember that.
Yeah.
That was one of the things also that was so well done in the film, was that the fight scenes, very well choreographed.
Great, yeah.
Long preparations, good preparations. And they're all different. Each fighting scene is different. One is one with weapons, the other one more with just equipment and the steel bars and stuff like that. Others just regular fist fights.
Yeah, I think we made lists, Vic list, and then we said, okay, how can we make them all as different as possible?
Exactly,
there was
that's
also
right.
One of the reasons we wanted to make the girl fight like interesting and new. To a certain degree, of course, you have to ask yourself from, let's say, from a psychological or physical point of view, what exactly was the relationship between Cohagen and Hauser, isn't it?
Right.
Because he seems to be really moved by the fact that he has to kill, you could say his buddy, you could even say that is even a vague suggestion that there was something else there, a love relationship or something, isn't it, between Cohagen and...
Yeah.
I mean, not that we emphasize that in any way, but there seemed to be sorrow in that scene before, isn't it, where he has to kill Hauser.
Yeah, oh, absolutely, because
really
they were best buddies.
Yeah,
I mean, they were working together.
Right.
I mean, he was definitely his right-hand guy when it comes to security.
Right. So, and now the last... phase of the movie, of course, is certainly action oriented and has to do with the discovery of the alien reactor, which we try to play here in a kind of a lightweight way, because she says, "What aliens?" I mean, like making a joke, isn't it? Because to introduce aliens into this story was not so easy, I felt, because it had its own realism, and now suddenly thinking, okay. We are dealing with aliens. It's like making a major step into science fiction, I felt.
Here's the mole again.
Yeah, we still don't know who it is, of course, who's doing this. But
right, right. Yeah, that machine is drilling right through any kind of obstacle. if it is concrete or...
So this is kind of... His tool to go against it, isn't it?
Right, right.
I'm gonna drill you, sucker! I'm gonna drive you off!
They're caught against the wall there, isn't it?
Right, right.
I'm coming! I'm coming for you, baby!
Machine is wiping out, of course, which was a great surprise to him that this huge machine can even break.
And basically it is interesting because it we use it also for the next scene, that hole in the wall they made, that is the way they get to into the nuclear reactor, isn't it?
Right, it goes into his body. Right through his...
He hears the sound and
he
basically...
Hears the sound, yeah.
And he finds out where it is.
Yeah, and as he finds
late,
out,
it?
It's too late, yeah.
Again, that shot was shortened.
Right.
Because we had some blood.
That's right, yeah.
So we had to
cut it out. He had too much gut falling out of his stomach.
Yeah, it was a little bit like that. And now, yeah, this was always a very important moment, I felt, because I thought if it would not be... It could easily be fake and idiotic, isn't it? This alien reactor hanging there in the air. So we tried to make it as realistic, and the idea ultimately was to go into an enormous nuclear reactor.
I remember shooting that scene. We had to hit a specific spot when we walked forward.
Yeah, because it was all blue screen.
Exactly, it was all blue screen. It was like 20 spots that we had to hit exactly.
Right.
Otherwise, we had to redo it again, and we did it over and over and over again.
Some of it is real, isn't it? This, of course, we built
really.
And the beginning of the bridge is real, but as the bridge extends here, that's all, of course, the foreground now and all the elements there, that is all matte paintings. Or partially, they are really miniatures that we built. Again, the bridge stops, where the shot stops, the bridge stops too, and the rest of the bridge is fake.
Right. Oh, this is a great scene where he uses the hologram. Isn't he using the hologram?
Yeah. Sometimes we use the for the wide shots, basically, and with the little people. In some of the shots, we use this very old technique where you would shoot the shot and you would project it inside the miniature.
Right.
That they also used a technique they used for King Kong, in fact. Of course, again, this is the columns that was based shot in the studio.
Right, right.
Now!
Well, you would expect him not to survive this.
Exactly.
You think there's something wrong with our bullets, isn't it?
Yeah.
Son of a bitch.
Yeah, I love that scene.
Yeah.
Coming from behind casually, turning off the hologram. And then just nailing them. He's still on the run.
I think they did body counts on this movie, didn't they?
Yeah. I think he has a record.
For the time, I would say.
For that time, yeah, exactly.
Do you think this is the real Quaid? It is.
Ha, Yeah, I think that was so creative, you know, that it made, because that's the key thing with those action movies, is to also have some humor.
Right.
In the middle of the action, in the middle of the intensity.
Yeah, otherwise it gets basically nearly too much, isn't it?
Yeah.
On the continuous action otherwise.
Here again, a totally different fight scene. A very brutal, hands-on kind of a fight scene, gouging the eyes, breaking arms.
Coming with me.
He realizes he's gonna get decapitated. Wow, oh, his arm's taken off. Another great shot.
Yeah. Okay, again, basically, the shot where the separation takes place had to be shortened a little
bit.
Oh,
yeah, sure, absolutely. Yeah.
But I'm glad we kept it in, because it's a really inventive scene, I think.
Terrific.
And then I think this is really what you would call the last element of the scene, of the movie, isn't it? The last important reveal. The hands we have seen before, and ultimately it turns out that if he puts his hand there in a certain way, that he can activate the machine. And of course, finalize what he was supposed to do in the first place, that is save the planet, isn't it? Like,
right.
Like promised in the recall office. We said at the end you will save the whole planet.
Mars will go into global meltdown. That's why the aliens never turned it on.
And you expect me to believe you?
Who gives a shit what you believe? In 30 seconds you'll be dead. Then I'll blow this place up and be home in time for cornflakes.
So now basically what the essence of this would be is that Cohagen, I mean from a, let's say... nearly from an economical point of view, would say that he had the possibilities to activate this reactor. He
right.
had the possibilities to use the nuclear reactor and make air on Mars. Basically, now, of course, the situation is that there is a limited amount of air, and basically the government makes money out of air.
Right, and they use it as a tool to make them perform, to make them work.
And basically even to keep control.
And to keep control, exactly.
Right. So it's again what every imperialist society would do, and that is what Cohagen stands for, I think. And in this case, of course, it's not about... It's really the air, the ultimate thing that we take for granted on Earth has been... in Mars is something that is only partially there, and is without it, of course, you can control everybody. So it is an economic and a control factor at the same time. A lot of these shots where you're hanging and in air were shot again with the set under
That's
a 90
right.
degree angle, isn't it?
That's
so
right.
when you see them here hanging on the horizontal line like her, in reality a shot like that would be shot if you on a vertical set, which is 90 degrees tilted, so then you use the gravity to hang down.
Right.
And then if you flip it back, then it's suddenly what is vertical, hanging down, becomes horizontal, being sucked out.
Right.
I think a lot of shots, you spent a lot of time there with Vic Armstrong on the set, hanging on these ropes, isn't it?
I remember every minute of it, of being suspended on harnesses.
Right.
Hanging on wires for hours and shooting that and climbing up and climbing down and all those kind of things.
This is one of the few shots that basically is real in the middle there. And from here we're back in the studio again. There was a little a red mountain outside Mexico City that we used for
right.
some of the shots really.
Yeah, I remember that. So that started now the nuclear reactor,
right.
which is now producing oxygen up there.
Now it turns out that all these things are telescopic, isn't it? So they can slowly go into the, not in the ground, because underneath there is supposed
the ice.
An ice layer.
Exactly, ice layer, which is the means of getting oxygen out.
Right, yeah. Right. Basically, we forget a little bit about the fact that we had to add nitrogen, otherwise it would be explosive, but I thought it would still be kind of a, let's say, pretty elementary way, but still not completely incorrect way, to say, okay, the nuclear reactor splits the oxygen out of the water and uses that for the air.
Right, look at his face. I mean, I love this.
That's the robotine again.
Popping out.
This is partially is real. The backgrounds are added, but the rolling down was done on that mountain in Mexico City. This is again on our little mini set that we used for the close shots.
Right.
And this is all miniatures, clearly, isn't it? That were built. They were not even that big, about a couple of rooms big. One room big, I would say. About 10 by 50 yards or something like that. I mean, Eric Brevet spent, with his miniature people, spent an enormous amount of time to get that. When you see them laying in that shot, in the white shot, that was one of these, I think, shots where we projected them inside the shot.
Right.
I mean, a miniature of the landscape, but the two bodies are projected into it. Nowadays, we would...
Now there's oxygen coming in. They're finally coming back slowly to life.
And then you get basically the oxygen. Yeah, but of course not enough nearly for them, because they nearly die anyhow. But
right.
And in the background, you see, under the window, you see the mountain where all these air streams are coming to the surface. I mean, clearly this is all miniatures, and it with additional streams, all the steam is added to the miniature. Now the right. Yeah. I mean, it's partially real. The glass is real. But of course, what comes through the window, what you see coming up through the window, the clouds are printed in blue screen wise, isn't it? But when it explodes, it's partially real. And some additional elements are added there. This is all real. This is stunt people and a real glass. I mean, fake glass. I mean, let's say not glass that can cut you, but...
Yeah, this was a major, major action sequence. Remember with cables, each one had to be pulled out by a cable. And, with the fire, the explosions, the smoke, the wind. The wind machines, they had all around the wind machines.
And this is puppets, isn't it, that do this? This is a robotine.
Right.
Bringing the puppet from a blown-up state to a normal state.
Yeah.
I mean, the clouds that are done in the water tank there in the mountain shot. This is all, I think, shots that were partially constructed in a water tank. Again, all these shots are blue screen, were shot as blue screen, and then the whole background was added.
Here everyone realizes for the first time that there is now oxygen on Mars, and that you can in fact exist. Now everyone has the right to breathe the oxygen, and there's no more dictatorship and all that.
I mean, the miniature in the background, clouds that are probably, as I think, matte paintings that are moved slowly.
Yeah.
And partially painted in. This is one of the first time, this is a tracking shot, because you see it's a crane shot, but we had no means to do that in the same way with motion controls cameras there. So it's really one of the first time that we track the actors without having, a computer program to repeat the move. So they had to... They really shot study frame pro frame so they had to really, so they could match the movement of the actors with the movement on the miniature.
Right.
Of course, clearly this is again, let's say, printed in a way that it's on a little projection screen. The real scene of the actors is done, and that's basically added into the miniature. We tried to have some people on the top of the mountains there, but it's not very visible. I can't believe it. It's like a dream. And this is the same. Again, this is
the same scene as the beginning, except without the helmets and without the gear.
Absolutely.
Well, then kiss me quick before you wake up.
And then we get to the music, we go back to the let's say, is it reality shot, isn't it?
Right, right.
Because everything at the end, I have suggested that that's really where his brains are, he's lobotomized at the end, isn't it? If we follow the dream story. But Edsmar told him that at the end, Dr. Edsmar by Roy Brockmuth, told him, at the end of the story, you will be lobotomized. That might be the end of the movie, isn't it? Because
that's
why we faded to white.
Yeah.
Instead of going to black. Because it's his brains are blown out, and so the whole story might be a dream, and ultimately nothing of all this happened. He all invented it, and because they couldn't bring him back to reality anymore, they decided to lobotomize him.
It's amazing if you think about this movie has come out 10 years ago.
Yeah, longer, 15 years ago.
No, 10 years ago.
20 years, no, 89, isn't it?
No, we made it in 89, it came out in 91.
Oh, did it?
So now it's 2001, so it's amazing, you know, that 10 years ago this movie came out, and how much it holds up today, even though we had much more crude technology then, and than we have today, but it's amazing how well it holds up, and how well everyone has acted in there, and how great the action was. The whole movie, I mean, really, I haven't seen it for a long time. To see it again and to see how well it plays, I can clearly see why it was such a huge phenomenon worldwide. Such a great success at the box office, and also got some great reviews.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we had a very talented crew and cast, you know. I think we had, we made a lot of good choices, I think.
For me, for my career, this movie was a very important move forward, because it was like the biggest action movie I've been involved in at that point, and a high, big budget movie, and huge worldwide, and it catapulted me forward. You know, I think it was one of the reasons why they didn't continue. It did then Terminator 2 and all those other type of movies.
Right, that's Erik Breivik, would I mentioned before, but. No, it's the same applies to me, because I had done Robocop, and that was kind of successful, but it was perhaps even more artistic than that it was commercial, isn't it? This was a really breakthrough.
Right. And I think that what was, of course, great about your career was that, you know, even though some people were saying, well, you know, that's, you know, he makes his money by doing action and all those, then you followed it up with Basic Instinct, and Basic Instinct made exactly the same amount. It was a huge hit worldwide again.
Which was without special effects.
Exactly. So so here was totally the opposite, and you were a huge smash.
Yeah, I think Rob Bottin and Erik Breivik both added a lot to this movie, isn't it? By giving us a lot of ideas too, isn't it? How to do it, and even extra elements that were not in the script.
Well, I think that it's so hard to pick, you know, one or the other department, because, I mean, if you look at that, just the wardrobe, how well it was designed, the set design, the visual effects, the stunt coordinating, the, you know, especially the directing. I mean, this is one of those movies which is a total director's movie. You know, it's your creation. You were in charge of this whole thing, because, as I was saying to everyone during my interviews when we promote the movie, you were the ideal guy, because you're great in directing actors and at the same time directing action, but also knowledgeable and interested in the technology of visual effects and special effects. So with that together makes it perfect for a movie like that.